You're listening to The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast.
G'day, I'm David Moyle. Welcome to The Informer. This week on The Informer, election campaign stumbles from Gladys Liu. We speak with the Australian Conservation Foundation to understand what was happening in environmental policy. Week two of the election campaign saw multiple stumbles and controversy on the campaign trail. Both leaders of the major parties at times struggled to explain parts of their policies. But it was some remarks from Gladys Liu, the Liberal Party candidate for Chisholm, that drew particular attention. A tape of the Liberal Party candidate claiming that members of the Chinese community believe that gay, transgender and intersex people are rubbish and destroyers has emerged. Gladys Liu is in a highly competitive race in the seat of Chisholm, the seat vacated by Julia Banks. Miss Liu was a very public campaigner against safe schools in 2016 and conducted an interview with The Guardian. After claiming that she had not made the comments and the story was fake news, The Guardian released the audio. Here is an excerpt of that interview.
A lot of Chinese parents, they just do not agree with letting boys go into a girl's toilet. So they strongly oppose the state school program. Not only toilet, it's also the cross-dressing, the introduction of transgender.
Yep.
It is something that they found it difficult to accept, especially to primary age children. The second thing is same-sex marriage. Now that is kind of related with the first one, because that is their belief that same-sex is just against normal practice. The Chinese people come to Australia because they want a good education for their children. They want good environment. They want good things for their next generation, not to be destroyed. They use the word destroyed by these sort of concepts of same-sex, transgender, and intergender. Cross-gender and all this rubbish. To them, they are just ridiculous rubbish.
The Informer asked Greens candidate for Higgins, Jason Ball, for his response to the comments.
Obviously, her comments are very disappointing, and I think it is a demonstration that the Liberal Party are scraping the bottom of the barrel when it comes to finding candidates to run for office. Those views are repugnant, they're ignorant, and, you know, to be putting forward such a candidate in a winnable seat for the Liberal Party, and not only that, but to have quite clearly lied and tried to cover up that lie and then being caught out just goes to the dishonesty of her, and someone who really, I don't think, as a result of this, should be trusted with the privilege of becoming a federal parliamentarian.
We also spoke to Labor's Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong and Labor candidate for McNamara Josh Burns for comment during a campaign stop at the Victorian Pride Centre.
Comments have emerged over the last couple of days. They were originally publicised in 2016 over Liberal Party candidate Gladys Liu's. She claimed she was repeating the views of the Chinese community on trans, intersex and gay people and used a number of quite offensive language. What was your reaction when you saw those comments?
Oh, I was sad. I mean, I think people who are hurtful about other people's families and other Australians and other people's kids. It's pretty sad, and I think the LGBTIQ community is, we know what that's like. I think most of us were pretty angry that she lied about it. So she tried to get out of it by saying she hadn't said it, and was quite clear she had. And this really is a matter for Mr. Morrison. I mean, if Scott Morrison wants people to believe that, what did Kelly O'Dwyer say? That his party isn't a bunch of women hating, homophobic,
climate change
deniers, then maybe he should get out and show people that they're actually not by making clear what his views are in respect of Ms. Liu. She's really a rogue candidate.
Mm-hmm.
In McNamara, the old seat of Melbourne Ports, 82% of people voted for marriage equality. It was one of the highest in the entire country. I think this is a place and this is a community where people are celebrated, where lovers love, and that's something that we should be absolutely celebrating and moving on. I think our country's moved on, and those sorts of views belong in the past. And this centre today, the Pride Centre, is about building for the future, and that's what we're focused on.
Penny, I kind of hate to put you on the spot in these kinds of situations, but you are, you know, probably the most visible LGBTIQ politician in the country. There are obviously, I know you hate compliments like that as well, there are obviously, and I know there's research on this, I know this from social circles of mine, that it is particularly challenging for young people who are from, whether it's from China or from Southeast Asia, to come out and to come out to their family. And I wonder if you had a message for young people who might be listening, who might be from diverse communities, whether you had a message for them or thoughts for them.
I think my message to all young people, regardless of community, regardless of background, is who you are is okay. You know, you are who you are, and that's great. And you should never be ashamed of who you are. You should never be hiding who you are. You should never feel that you're somehow lesser because you're not. Who you are is great. And, you know, that we remember that. And I know that, you know, all of us, all of our community have had different times in our lives had to confront challenges about identity and who we are and confront prejudice, and everybody has stories about that. And the sad thing about the marriage equality campaign was how much of that, I think, was really re-evoked for people. It was very, you know, I saw a lot of very distressed people. But, you know, the upside is the country voted for inclusion and the country voted for marriage equality, and it was a profoundly important statement. So I hope that not just this Pride Centre, but all of us who are, and you and others who enjoy FM, all of us in who have the opportunity to make public comment, that we can keep affirming these messages of acceptance and respect for all young people. And say, you're okay. Everybody's got their own journey. We all have to manage our personal relationships and work out how we handle them. But, you know, do that with pride in who you are.
The informer approached Gladys Liu for comment. She rejected any suggestion that the comments were her own views and said that she firmly supports equality across the community.
You're listening to The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast.
Environmental policy was an important battlefield this week, and to get some insight into where the parties stand on particular environmental issues, Toby Halligan spoke with the Australian Conservation Foundation's Director of Campaigns, Paul Sinclair.
There's some really clear differences on where the parties stand at the moment. And just as a little bit of context, that this week there's been some really important polling out showing that lots of voters are putting the environment and climate change as one of their top two issues. So certainly voters are expecting strong action on climate change and protecting the environment. We've done an assessment of where the parties were at the end of February, and we'll be launching a scorecard 2 weeks out from the election campaign, which people can get at our website, acf.org.au. So at the moment, where the parties are at, based on policies they've released to the end of February, the Liberal Party is doing really poorly across climate change, across stopping Australia's reliance on coal, and in protecting nature. They get across on all the major policy issues that we're assessing parties on. The Labor Party have got good policies to ramp up clean energy. They've got good policies around opposing giving public money to the Adani mine. They've got sort of iffy policies around fair pollution reduction commitments, iffy policies around commitments to environmental laws. The Greens have got strong policies, as you would expect, across clean energy, coal, and protecting nature. So we're hoping between now and polling day that we'll see some really strong advances in the Labor Party's position on coal, Adani, and protecting nature. And we would really hope that the Liberal Party will do something unusual and amazing and start saying some strong positive things around Adani and get moving on to clean energy. But sadly, that has not been occurring so far.
There have been some very important news in the last couple of weeks regarding the Adani mine. Can you give us an update on that?
Yeah, well, this morning I almost actually choked on my Wheaties, Toby, because there was the Morrison government got caught red-handed with doing something pretty dodgy in approving a set of licences to allow the Adani mine to take a lot of groundwater out of a drought-affected area in Queensland where the mine's going to be built. And it looks as though that they have really put pressure on some of Australia's leading scientists to distort the approval process for the mine, and that was done 2 days before the election was called. So Minister Price looks as though she was bullied by some male colleagues from Queensland to rush through approvals, and that is looking pretty dodgy at the moment.
Right, and so does that mean then effectively if say a Liberal government were re-elected, the mine would be certain to happen? What happens? What's the difference between the parties there in terms of shaping people's votes?
Yeah, the Adani mine is still awaiting a couple of approvals from the Queensland state government, but at the moment the Liberal Party are really backing the Adani mine in, and it looks to us like they're doing everything they can to get the mine built. They've accepted $60,000 in donations from the Adani Corporation, for example. Unfortunately, the Labor Party are doing a bit of wibble-wobble on the issue. We're not 100% sure what their position is at the moment, and we would hope that Tony Burke and Bill Shorten, between now and Election Day, make a commitment to review the environmental approval granted to the Adani Corporation, because what's been made clear this morning by the ABC story is that the process has been extremely dodgy and has been under the influence of severe pressure from Adani and their backers in the Liberal government.
That was Paul Sinclair from the Australian Conservation Foundation.
This is The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast.
The fallout from Israel Folau's homophobic posts has continued. The rugby star has received widespread condemnation, but looks set to fight Rugby Australia's efforts to terminate his $4 million contract. The Informer spoke to ex-AFL footballer, Greens candidate and founder of the Pride Cup, Jason Ball, about his reaction to Folau's post.
Reading Israel Folau's comments took me back to a time when I was 12 years old and first coming to terms with my sexuality and really struggling with that. On the playgrounds and on the footy field, the word gay was used to mean bad or weak or stupid or disgusting. And I internalized that, and, you know, that it was a really hard time for me. And I guess any time I see in the public domain people spouting homophobia, you need to remember that children are listening and they don't have the same resilience that we as adults have. And so we need to be conscious of that. And Rugby Australia need to be aware of their brand and what their ambassadors are saying about rugby players and the culture within rugby. And for me, the sporting world was the hardest place to come out. And my story is not an isolated one. The research has shown that 80% of Australians have experienced homophobia specifically in the sporting environment. The impact that this has is that 9 out of 10 young gay people who play sport feel the need to be in the closet, or they stop playing sport, usually around the age of 15 or 16. Even gay spectators, 75% don't feel safe attending live sporting events. So completely putting aside for one moment the fact that homophobia is a contributing factor towards the disproportionate rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide experienced by the LGBTIQ community. When it comes to the sporting world, we have a long way to go to making that environment inclusive and welcoming for LGBTIQ people. That's Rugby Australia's mission. All of our major sporting codes have made pledges of some variety to stamp out homophobia and transphobia and make their environments more welcome. And given this was the second time that Israel Folau had breached their social media guidelines in vilifying LGBTIQ people, I think that they made the right call in the response.
I mean, it is a call, though, that's been a year coming. When he originally made the comments, some of the reasons that were provided by Rugby Australia for not firing him then related to freedom of speech and freedom of religion. How do you respond to those kinds of explanations?
I am a big advocate of both freedom of speech and freedom of religion, but it's important to note that no freedom is absolute and no freedom is without consequences. So Israel Folau is free and he did express himself. No one is stopping him from expressing himself, but he needs to realise if his employer has a specific code of conduct and he is not adhering to that with his right to express his religion and his right to express his speech and his opinions, he needs to face the consequences of that. And the consequences are both of himself in potentially losing his contract, but the consequences are also felt across the community in terms of the way in which the LGBTIQ community, an already marginalized group, when it comes to what we put up with, and it speaks beyond just a political opinion. When you are vilifying a group of people because of who they are, we don't put up with it when it comes to race. We should not put up with it when it comes to people's sexuality or gender identity either.
There's been some commentary that there is a larger problem here in terms of employers regulating what people say on social media. These are an attempt to draw the line between professional selves and private selves. Obviously, in the last couple of years, we've seen a few examples of people being fired for comments that were controversial in different sections of the community. SBS football commentator Scott McIntyre for comments regarding the Anzacs. Yasmin Abdul-Majeed suffered enormous backlash for social media comments. What's your response to those kinds of arguments about there being an issue with regulating what we say on social media?
There is a clear distinction in all of those cases and Israel's, and that is that the other cases involve people expressing their political opinion. But those opinions didn't vilify someone or a group of people because of who they are. That's where this has gone across, breached what Rugby Australia consider acceptable. So I don't have a problem with people expressing their personal opinions or even their political allegiances or political beliefs. I don't think people should be sanctioned for expressing those. But where we draw the line is where people are being vilified. You know, if we're talking about sexism or racism or homophobia, that is the type of speech that is in our society and setting it up and in organisations if they want to have some control over what their employees put out there, that there are allowed to be a certain standard that they expect.
Is part of the issue here as well that we have mainstream faiths within Australia that have embedded within them homophobic or misogynistic or at times racist views that they kind of continue to propagate? What I'm kind of trying to get at here is, let's say Israel Folau earnestly believes these things and he may or may not be hateful or not, like I think his comments were clearly hateful in tone, but isn't the fundamental problem here that mainstream faiths that continue to play a very substantial role in Australian society propagate bigoted views?
Look, my take on it is that it's not necessarily the religion that is inherently the problem, because there are many different ways that religious texts and religious beliefs can be interpreted. And there are many people in the world who are able to reconcile their Christian faith and their interpretation of the Bible that doesn't in any way vilify the LGBTIQ community. And Israel Folau is taking a very narrow interpretation, a very literal interpretation of the Old Testament, if you wanted to look at it from a theological perspective. And, you know, there are many things said in the Old Testament that, you know, when it comes to an endorsement of slavery or owning women as property or selling them to your neighbor, we don't pretend that these are values that are intrinsic to the Christian faith, but we're getting to the point in history where we are moving on from that as a society and realizing that sexuality is an innate characteristic that a person has. These interpretations, whether it's because the Bible is bunch of fiction, or whether it's because we've been interpreting it wrong, I don't care which way you look at it. Mm. But at the end of the day, we need to be protecting the LGBTIQ community from vilification, whether it's religious or otherwise. Mm. And I think that at the end of the day, the religious aspect of it is often a cloak or an excuse for prejudices that people may already hold. The other thing that is particularly problematic when it comes to the fire and brimstone rhetoric of Israel Folau's comments is that it has all of the hallmarks of a practice known as gay conversion therapy. The beliefs within some aspects of the Christian faith that it is a sin to be gay, or that people therefore need to pray away the gay or can change their sexuality, is probably one of the most dangerous ideologies that when it comes to the mental health and well-being of LGBTIQ people of faith. A report was released by La Trobe University that showed that this practice is still happening in Australia. There are moves to outlaw it. Those moves are being supported here in Victoria by the state Labor government. Our Prime Minister, unfortunately, the Liberal Party are not quite there yet, but I think that is where we need to be going, and is where some other countries in the world have gone, because to send the message to young gay people who of faith that they need to choose between who they are and their family and their religious community is incredibly problematic for those people. And we need to be, as much as possible, putting out a positive, affirming message to show the examples of just how many people out there do find a way to reconcile their faith with their sexuality. Bishop Jean Robinson, who ordained Barack Obama when he won the presidency, is one example.
The Israel Folau story has received a huge amount of coverage, and for young LGBTIQ plus people who are involved in sport, it can be quite disheartening. You're one of Australia's most prominent LGBTIQ plus athletes. What would you say the role of sport can play in this space?
Well, I think Israel Folau's views have made headlines precisely because they are actually so far out of step with the culture that is currently being fostered by major sporting code. Rugby Union are one code who have made great strides towards inclusion. The Bingham Cup, for example, the Gay Rugby World Cup, is smashing stereotypes and breaking down barriers. The NRL were part of Mardi Gras for the past 2 years and had Macklemore perform the same love at their NRL Grand Final. In my sport of AFL, we've seen the Pride Game become an annual fixture in both the men's and the women's elite competition, you know, covering the grounds and the crowd in rainbow colours to be a symbol of inclusion and acceptance. And then, you know, at the grassroots level, last year I founded Pride Cup, a new non-profit organisation that now have 45 communities who are signed up to hold Pride-themed sporting matches in 2019. So there are shifts happening within the sporting landscape. So we are working towards a world where people don't have to choose between the sport they love and being themselves. And I think Israel Folau's comments really are a minority when it comes to the sporting world, and an attitude that is quickly dying, and you know, good riddance.
Seems like, to a degree, this is an issue. I know a number of elite female athletes, and there is a, frankly, many more of them are out. So to a degree, this culture of elite athletes not coming out, while it's absolutely not exclusively a male thing, does appear to be particularly dominant within the elite male codes. Do you think that's changing?
Not yet. I mean, we're getting there. We have seen many more straight athletes become allies to the LGBTIQ community in a myriad of different ways. It is now not seen as something that is an unmasculine thing to do, to show your support for the LGBTIQ community or to challenge homophobia. In fact, there's a lot of respect that has come from players such as David Pocock in rugby union, or, you know, Matt Spanger or Brock McLean or Dan Jackson within the AFL. But obviously we've still got a way to go. There are very few openly gay male sports stars in the world, but, you know, that there are some. We have some gold medal winning Olympic athletes who are openly gay, but within the team sports there's still a lot of room to improve. And that is, I guess, I can see the sporting codes doing that. They're creating a place where if a player wanted to come out, that they should hopefully in today's day and age now feel supported enough to do so. And at the end of the day, you know, this is not about forcing anyone out of the closet, but creating an environment where they feel safe to do so if they want to.
This has been The Informer. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and review on iTunes. It helps others to find the show.